Welcome to the Competent Pastor Podcast.
A podcast by pastors for pastors that starts with one question.
What is the most important skill of a competent pastor?
We're your hosts. I'm Michael Danner.
And I'm Rachel Ringenberg-Miller.
Today we're thrilled to talk to Hugh Hollowell. Hugh is a sixth-generation Mississippian, a descendant of enslavers, and is the pastor of Open Door Mennonite Church in Jackson, Mississippi, a multiracial peace church formed in the aftermath of the Civil Rights Movement. Hugh is a writer and storyteller and has been the publisher of a newsletter called Life is So Beautiful for more than a decade. Before becoming pastor at Open Door, Hugh spent 12 years working as a pastor among unhoused people and those struggling with addictions. This taught him much of what he knows about both second chances and grace, but not as much that is useful at congregational meetings. He and his spouse, Renee, live in the Foundren neighborhood of Jackson, where they run a small-scale kitten rescue called Purr and Pounce and live with four permanent cats and five chickens.
Well, hello, everyone, to the Competent Pastor Podcast. Today we have with us Hugh. So welcome, Hugh, to the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here.
So the question we'd like to begin with before we get into our main question is tell us a little bit about how you got into ministry. Tell us a little about your ministry journey.
Yeah, I say that I backed into ministry. So in, gosh, like 2006, I was in Raleigh, North Carolina. Some friends and I were volunteering at a, quote, homeless ministry. And it was horrible. I mean, it was ran by these hyper fundamentalist people who, you know, you had to listen to a 20-minute sermon before you could eat. If you were visibly gender variant, they would like pray over you without your consent, right? Mm-hmm. It was horrible, and a lot of churches that saw themselves as progressive were supporting this ministry, largely because there was no alternative, right? Like, I mean, to them, this is what faith-based engagement with the unhoused population looked like. And I came across a quote by Richard Rohr to the effect that the best critique of the bad is the doing of the good. And so we were like, we could do better than this, right? And so, so we started this, what eventually became a nonprofit, designed to engage the unhoused community from a faith-based perspective. And the people who were showing up were largely Quakers and Mennonites showing up to help us. And so one day I woke up and I said, I should go check out the Quakers. And this was, you know, back before smartphones and Google Maps and all that. So I'm like, pull up my laptop and search for the Quakers in Raleigh to find out where they're fellowship was, and their website was down that day. So I'm like, I guess I'll go see the Mennonites. And theirs was working, which is why it's important to have a good website for your church. So I ended up at Raleigh Mennonite. Dwayne Beck was the pastor there at the time. And this was immediately Melissa Flora-Bixler would succeed him. But at the time, Dwayne was the pastor there. And they welcomed me. And I fell in love with the people. And they embraced me. And the thing that I loved most about it was when I would go and speak at other congregations about the work I was doing, they kind of treated me like this poor man's Mother Teresa. This is Hugh. He knows poor people, right? You know, but at Raleigh Mennonite, it was like, you know, there's the woman who, like, worked in Africa as a midwife for 20 years. Here's the people who gave up their business to move to the inner city. Here's the people who teach, you know, like, it was the first time in my life that I experienced church as a support group for the rest of my life, rather than as my primary expression of my Christianity. And so I fell in love with them. And then in a very Mennonite way, after 6 months or so, Dwayne is like, you know, what you're doing is ministry. And I'm like, it is not ministry. Like, I am the most unlikely of ministers. And they're like, and he's like, no, no, absolutely. Well, think about it. And I said, I'll think about it. Another week or two goes by, and someone else comes up to me, and they're like, how do we support your ministry? I'm like, it is not a ministry. Anyway, that happened 4 or 5 times. And as far as I know, like, in like, they weren't, like, collaborating behind the scenes, right? It was just independent confirmation from various people in the community. And then... I don't know. Do you all know Brenda North Martin? Brenda used to be conference minister in Virginia Conference years and years and years ago.
Yeah, I know who she is. I don't.
Yeah.
I
don't know. Yeah. So Brenda attends Raleigh Mennonite, and one day Brenda pulled me to the side and she said, "It occurs to me that you would be much more use to the people you're working with if we ordained you." Because Reverend Hollowell can get into places that Mr. Hollowell can't. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're in the South, right? Even the atheists are Christians down here. And so and I said, well, you know, that makes sense. And so Raleigh Mennonite launched into a year of discernment because we're Mennonites and do nothing quickly. And then there was this man... Don Bickle. Don was 85, probably, had an oxygen tank, was a retired school teacher, and spent 4 days a week at the women's prison tutoring, and was mad because his doctor had asked him to step down from 6 days a week tutoring, right? And Don was this kind of, like, gruff, curmudgeonly, lovable old man, and we're in the church life meeting, and we talked about what we're doing and that these are the reasons we think we should license Hugh for ministry. And Don said, "We've been talking about this for a year. I say the quicker the better." And that was when that was how I ended up as a licensed. That was in 9, and then I was ordained in 11.
Okay.
And so, yeah, and I spent the next 12 years, well, I spent 12 years working, doing pastoral ministry among the unhoused folk in Raleigh. Mm-hmm. And the last 3 years I was there, Melissa was pastor at Raleigh Mennonite. And so any similarity between my answers and Melissa's answers are purely because I largely learned how to be a pastor by watching and listening to Melissa. Mm-hmm. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how would you describe your faith background before encountering the Mennonites?
Yeah, I'm a sixth generation Mississippian. I grew up in Mississippi. My people are here and as long as we've been in Mississippi, we were Methodists.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I would say on the more evangelical end of the Methodist church, you know, it's a big tent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it was a small church. I mean, I grew up 10 miles outside of town at 800 people. Okay. And it was a small church. My great grandfather's name is on the cornerstone. But it also left the denomination, it was an independent Methodist church, because it left the denomination in 69 rather than admit people of color to membership.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm. So that's not how they tell the story now, but sure.
That's what happened.
Yeah.
What did your ministry look like? You know, people said, hey, how can we support you in this ministry? And so what about it?
Yeah, I would largely say now it was presence and accompaniment. Mm-hmm. That's not how I necessarily, not language I had at the time.
Yeah.
If this was a secular podcast, I would say we were working from a harm reduction perspective.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. But it was largely accompaniment, and support. It was really what I thought I was doing there in the beginning was not what I actually ended up doing there. I thought I was going there. I had these naive ideas around, you know, like I'm going to help these people, right?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. If I had been pressed, I would even have thought I was in some way saving these people in all the senses of the word, right? But in reality, they taught and saved me. It was there that I learned about grace, and I learned about second chances, and I learned about that none of us live up to all of the hopes and dreams we have for ourselves. But I learned very little that is useful in a church meeting.
Yes, depending on what kind of church meeting. But yeah,
right, exactly.
I hear what you're saying. Yeah,
yeah.
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 So what sustained you through that ministry period?
You know, that's actually a great setup. I imagine based on the question, like we'll talk a lot about that. But mm-hmm. but really it was so early on, I had a mentor. So I was probably 18 months in, and I was flailing, right? I had all these naive, hopeful visions of what I was going to do, and people kept dying, and people, like, would relapse, and people would ghost you, and people would hurt you, mm-hmm. right? And I was fried, and I reached out to, I reached out to Bart Campolo. I don't know if y'all know Tony Campolo's son. Mm-hmm. Tony was a childhood hero of mine, and I had met his son at a thing, and he really impressed me. He had done at that time inner city work for about 30 years, and I reached out to him and I just said, "Man, I'm flailing. I'm circling the drain, right?" And he replied, and he said, "You know, if you were going to walk across the desert tomorrow, you would spend a day drinking as much water as you possibly could in order to, like, gorge yourself to sustain you on this journey." He said, "It occurs to me that you see a lot of really bad and ugly things." He said, "So I think it's probably more important to your long-term success in ministry that you know where the museum is than that you know where the homeless shelter is." Mm. He said, "You should fill yourself up with as much beauty as you possibly can to sustain you when you're on this, surrounded by all this ugliness." Mm-hmm. And then he said, "You know, people who don't do this work love to talk about helping people change." He said, "But most people don't change very much." He said, "So I've come to find it helpful to think of this less about getting things done and more about how you walk beside people on a long, hard journey." And beauty and seeing yourself not as fixing people, but as walking beside them on a long, hard journey. Those two things saved me.
That's probably a great transition into the actual, the main question of the podcast.
Shut up.
So, in your opinion, your vast experience, lot of different experiences. So in your view, what is the most important skill of a competent pastor?
I just want to say a couple of things first. Like, you know, it feels like very Mennonite, like, modesty that we're not talking about excellent pastors or amazing pastors or highly successful pastors, but competent pastors, right? Like, kind of like how on my ordination certificate, I'm called to be a minister, but it's a lowercase m, lest I get any pride.
You're just involved. Deeply satisfied is what you are.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So the other thing is that I often joke there are three rules to ministry, but no one will tell me what they are. So, yeah, you know, I did listen to several other people, and every time I listened, I'm like, yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. I really think if I had to pick one, it would probably be how to know when to not be a pastor. So, and let me explain. This is a weird gig, okay? Like, your job is to build a community. One of your jobs is to build a community that you don't get to fully be part of. You know, I've worked with lots of people who had alcohol addiction. And if one of my congregants were suffering from alcohol addiction, I really hope that they would feel safe enough to tell me and also safe enough to tell another member of the congregation. If I were suffering from alcohol addiction, in no way would it be safe or wise for me to share that with my congregation, right? Mm-hmm. Especially not if I wasn't getting treatment or whatever for it. And so, it's a one-sided relationship in some ways. And people say that it's not, but like, you know, staff parish relation committees, they exist. They're a thing. My current one is awesome, by the way. I just want to put that in there. it's a one-sided relationship in some ways, right? Like, mm-hmm. And so it's almost like Instagram, how, you know, like, if your spouse gives you flowers, you share that on Instagram. If your spouse leaves their underwear on the floor and that ticks you off, you don't share that on Instagram. So it becomes this curated way.
Yeah.
As a pastor, that we often feel this pressure, some of it's internal, some of it's culture, to curate who we are for our congregation. And a danger is that you begin to believe that curation. Right. Yeah. So when I was, you asked earlier what sustained me during that time. One of the things was I had a number of friends who weren't religious at all. I mean, it's not that they were anti-religious. It just wasn't part of their life. Right. A dear friend of mine, Abby, was a psychologist, and her day off was Tuesday, and every Tuesday for 9 years we had lunch together. And it helped put some of the stuff I was enduring in perspective, right? And like how people mm-hmm. who aren't caught in this world like would see it. And it also, it was grounding, you know, that a life exists outside of your congregation, outside of the people you're ministering to, all of that. So, you know, and the other thing is that, yeah, it's I think part of not taking yourself so seriously. I have since learned there are as many ways to be a pastor as there are pastors, and maybe more ways to be a pastor than there are pastors. You know, like on social media, there are those people who are like professional spiritual people. They have pictures on, their profile pictures of them praying. I mean, Jesus said nothing about it. So like, you know, when you're on Instagram, do not pray. Right, in
don't
public.
Show yourself how you're praying.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. That, mm-hmm.
Don't go to the digital street corner.
Right, exactly.
Throw your hands up to heaven.
Right. I mean, what isn't forbidden is permitted, I guess. It's really easy to get caught up in believing, you know, and our congregations want to believe that about us. They want to believe that their pastor is in some way holier than they are or more spiritual than they are. And I don't think we are, right? It's just it's just a thing I get to think about all the time, right?
It's kind of like when you're in a room full of people at your church, let's say, and it's time to pray and everyone looks at you. And I remember a couple times in congregational ministry being like, saying maybe a little frustratedly, like, y'all can pray too. Like, I'm happy to do it. Right. And also, you too can pray.
Well, so I'm now at Open Door, Mennonite in Jackson. And for the past 2 years, I've been the solo pastor there. And one of the things that we've done is, other than, I think, maybe you, Rachel, when you were in town, when I've not preached, we've not brought in outsiders to preach. We get lay people from the congregation to preach. Because I want them to understand that you can do this too, right? Like, I am not, I don't have the direct download. You know, the Holy Spirit speaks through all of us, not just through those of us who have an ordination certificate on the wall.
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of want to go back to your curated self. Because that kind of resonated with me in terms of thinking about the relationships that I had in the various congregations I served and how there was, you know, we would be at a social gathering with friends who happened to also attend the same church. But for me, there was always kind of this blockage of things that I would not say or questions I would not answer or comments about people that I know more than these folks, but I'm not going to say anything. And so it was an interesting, you know, I started calling it my pastor brain or the pastor lock, right? I'm fully with these people in a social setting. And also, if we start going down the church conversation, I'll contribute, but I'm not going into the depths of what I do know or what I could say. And it's an interesting balance to hold. And you also have to trust the people you are with at the same time, because you need to have friendships.
I mean, you do.
That's like one of the key points of a pastor in their longevity, in their resiliency, is friends, social connection. So how do you find those?
Yeah. I mean, and I would argue that some, or at least I would even say most of those deep friendships need to be with people you're not pastoring. Because the, you know, that knowledge differential is just too great. I know things about you that no one else knows, and you know almost nothing about me that I don't specifically curate for you.
One of the other challenges, at least for me, at least with the curated, that idea of the curated life is how it actually impacts also your spouse and children if you have them. And often I think even the PK phenomenon is because they get drug into this curated life, often feeling a lot of pressure to be a particular way publicly because of it. And they know you mm-hmm. really well off stage. And so they see that, you know, it's no wonder that there's a little bit of cynicism or perhaps a little bit of even religious folks can be hypocritical, things of that nature, if you really engage in that. So
absolutely.
That was probably the thing that helped me the most, like, to get away from that kind of curated self of saying, I can't like lay this on my wife and kids. And of course there's always stuff in family life that you just, you know, when you're not at your best, you don't want your kids telling those stories. But at the same time, my philosophy always was, if I did it, you can tell it.
Right.
Because I did it. That's my responsibility. It's not yours.
Yeah.
That's a fascinating.
Yeah. I have a friend who is a preacher's kid, and she says that I spent the first 18 years of my life being a sermon illustration. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's worth noting she's not in the church now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 I'm sorry, this is a Melissa Forbes for Stan account now, I think it was Melissa was the first person I ever heard say that she wouldn't use her children as sermon illustrations as a conscious decision because she was ordained. They weren't she chose this life. Yeah. Right. And they didn't. I've always really respected that.
Yeah, there is something to be said about how does the pastor's family involved in a church, and what do they do? What do they don't, you know, what do they not do?
Right.
I started when my kids got a little bit older, I would ask permission if I could tell a particular mm-hmm. story. Mm-hmm. So far, but I don't really use, I use them at convention. So I can't say that it's been a while. I literally use them during that sermon.
In the largest platform,
MCUSA. I said, my kids made me watch a Star Wars movie.
Yes. Broadcast all over the internet, right? Like documented.
Yes.
Your daughter was on the stage.
That's true. My daughter was also on the stage. So it's all in the family, I guess.
Permission to talk about it.
But yeah, no, those things are important and key. And I just also think about like, then when you move into different spaces with different friends and how everyone interacts then, you know, outside of the church space, hopefully it's fairly similar-ish, right? Like hopefully your curated self isn't so off from your, for lack of a better word, self.
Sure. I had someone one time who had only known me online, who met me in person, and they're like, "You're much nicer in person." And I said, "Well, I guess that's better than the other way, right?
Yeah.
Like, I would hate it if someone said, you know, like that Hugh, he's great on the internet, but he's a jerk in real life, like."
Exactly.
Weren't you on? But you were on the cover of the Mennonite, right, in a clerical collar, marching down the street at one point. Picture, remember?
It's on the wall.
So that looked a little like,
So I was told
I wouldn't want to mess with you. That's the impression I got, or get in the way of you.
Someone described me
making.
As the Mennonite they want on their side in a bar fight.
Yeah,
I was told actually that I set two records with that issue. Because I was the only Mennonite pastor to ever appear on the cover of the Mennonite in a clerical collar. Mm-hmm. Mm. But also I had a T-shirt over it.
Yeah.
And I was also the first Mennonite pastor to ever appear on the cover in a T-shirt. Mm. So
that's a two.
My
two
claim
four.
To fame.
Wow. Right. You're really hitting them. So,
you said a lot of things that have, got me thinking about a bunch of stuff. But I'm curious about this intersection between... you said that congregations want to believe their pastor is holier than they are.
Yeah.
And I think that's true. And at the same time, part of your story, at least with Brendan North Martin, is that there's a strategic ordination is what I would call it. There's some power in the pastoral mantle that allows us to do some things that we might not be able to do without it.
Oh, absolutely.
And so I'm curious about that intersection, because sometimes it seems to me like when people are struggling, they actually need a good role model of faithfulness to hold on to. And so all those things mixed together for me is kind of, you need to be authentic and healthy in front of people, but also there's this sense of which, yeah, sometimes you believe on behalf of others that are in the midst of struggling. And is that, how does that resonate with you? Any thoughts about that kind of?
Yeah. So in the second chapter of Mark, one of my favorite stories is when they tear the roof off the house and lower the disabled man, right? Mm-hmm. And the line in scripture says something to the effect of, Jesus saw the faith of the man's friends and forgave his sins. Mm-hmm. Not his faith, but the faith of his friends. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, we know nothing about the guy. We don't know if he was a good guy or a bad guy. We don't know if he, like, hurt his back rescuing a kitten or escaping an angry husband. Right? Like, we don't know. Mm-hmm. And it seems Jesus seems unconcerned with it, right? Instead, he is counting on the faith of the man's friends and accredits that to the man's account, right? And so, yeah, in some ways, so I am, a gift I got from 12 years of frontline homeless engagement was deep-seated cynicism. I also got almost incurable hope too, which makes it hard to plan your day, honestly. But I do recognize that if I want to talk to the mayor, Reverend Hollowell from Open Door Mennonite Church will get an interview, whereas Mr. Hollowell, who lives in Fondren, will not, right? Mm-hmm. There is power that comes with, quite frankly, there's privilege that comes with, especially in the South, mm-hmm. that comes with the ministerial role. Mm-hmm. And, you know, privilege is really just like something you didn't ask for. Mm-hmm. Didn't ask to be white, didn't ask to be cisgendered, didn't ask to be straight. And while I did, I guess, ultimately ask to be a pastor, I didn't ask for the privileges that accompany that. Mm-hmm. So I don't feel any shame around that. But I would feel shame if I didn't use that for the benefit of people who don't have that privilege, right? In some levels, it's very strategic. Mm-hmm. Less so now that I'm pastoring a, quote, traditional church, although if you've been to Open Door, there's nothing traditional about it. But a more typical pastoral situation. But it's real. People see me as their pastor. I function as their pastor. I do pastoral things. But it also, like, I would, if as has been threatened before, if I lost my credentials, I could still do everything that I currently do at Open Door, right? I don't need the magic piece of paper or the reverend in front of my name in order to do what I do. But as I said when I was ordained, I came to see that the several years I was doing street-level engagement work, eventually the Mennonites did convince me that what I was doing was ministry. And so the ordination didn't determine if I got to be a minister. It only determined if MCUSA was going to recognize that. I'm sorry, that's a word salad, but I think about this a lot, right?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Thank you. Yeah, we're just sitting here. This is what happens when we're thinking too much about stuff you've said.
Stump the interviewers.
No, so another connection, you mentioned harm reduction earlier as kind of a friend. And as you were telling the story about the Jesus' disposition towards the man lowered to the roof and how he just healed him without any sort of concern.
Right.
The stats of his life didn't matter. He was a human being in need of healing. His friends had faith. Can you explain? I know a lot of folks maybe listening don't know or aren't familiar with harm reduction strategies.
Sure.
They're also, so maybe explain that. And also they're really, at least in my experience, I have a good friend that works in harm reduction. And religious people sometimes don't like him very much.
Right.
And yet I think
your friend and I have in common.
Yeah. I think that it strikes me as it's kind of the closest to what I would see Jesus doing in ministry. And I don't know if that gives you anything to go on.
Yeah, no. So there are things. There is the world as it should be and the world as it is. Okay. If I were preaching on this, I would talk about the already and the not yet. Right. And so in the world as it should be, people would not drive recklessly. But in the world as it is, people do drive recklessly. And so the question then becomes, if you accept the fact that people are going to drive recklessly, because we live in the world as it is, how do we keep as many of those people from dying as possible? Mm-hmm. Well, we pass seatbelt laws. Seatbelt laws are a great example of harm reduction. In the world as it is, in the world as it should be, seatbelts would, if not be unnecessary, definitely like not needed as much as they are now, right? Mm-hmm. So motorcycle helmet laws are another example of harm reduction. Ideally, people wouldn't drive 120 miles an hour on their motorcycle, but they do. So when they have inevitable wrecks, how do we keep them, as many of them, alive as possible? Where our religious friends kick is in the world as it should be, people probably wouldn't inject heroin. But in the world as it is, they do. So by making sure they have clean needles to inject heroin, they stay alive longer so that they can make a choice to quit heroin, because dead people don't change. Right. And so if we truly desire to see people change, then keeping them alive as long as possible so that they have the opportunity to change is probably a wise decision. A lot of religious people choose to live in the world as it ought to be. My teenage daughter ought not be having sex. The reality is that teenage children have always had sex. And so making sure that your teenage daughter is on contraceptives, making sure your teenage son knows how to use birth control, those are examples of harm reduction. Mm-hmm. And it's easy to get caught up in the world as it ought to be and assume that that is how people do in fact act. And some people do in fact act that way, but some people don't, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're caught up in the world as it ought to be, you don't have a conversation with your 14-year-old son about birth control, and thus, on his sexual debut, he ends up impregnating someone, which then disrupts multiple lives, mm-hmm. right? Because we were caught up in the world as it ought to be, instead of in the world as it is. And so, from our perspective, that did look like making sure that there were birth control, contraceptives available, at soup kitchens. It also meant making sure that people who were sleeping outside had blankets and sleeping bags, right? Was it ideal in the world as it should be? Should people be sleeping outside? No, they should not be. But if they are sleeping outside, should they freeze to death because of their refusal to line up with what you think they ought to be doing? I think not, right? And so, we were often embattled with people who saw this as enabling or condoning bad behavior. Mm-hmm. I got a hate mail letter one time from a woman who wanted to know why a Christian ministry, her words, was passing out condoms instead of sharing the good news of Jesus Christ. And I said, well, you know, we have not found prayer to be an efficacious birth control method. So we're all for praying, but we're mainly praying people don't get pregnant while they're outside.
I feel like that's a great way to explain it. I mean, especially within the religious framework too, right? The world as it is, the world as it ought to be. I think that's a really clear way to kind of say, all right, what is our role mm-hmm. as religious people then, given the reality of which we live?
Right. And it doesn't mean that I don't want people to be in the world right. as it ought to be. It doesn't mean I'm not working for the world as mm-hmm. it ought to be. Mm-hmm. But again, if Jimbo is dead because he overdosed, he's not going to quit drugs, right?
Right.
And so if we can keep him alive long enough to make a decision that he wants to change.
Mm-hmm. And provide space and relationship and people
absolutely.
And all of that stuff, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. At the end of the day, people change when they're ready to change.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they don't when they're not ready to change. Mm-hmm. You know, the joke in the diet industry is that if you want to lose weight, virtually any diet will work.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to be on the Big Mac diet or the popcorn diet or the cabbage diet, like all of them work if you're like dedicated and committed to it. And if you're not, none of them do.
Mm-hmm.
People change when they're ready to change. And when they're ready, they're going to reach out to people that they know and trust.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I wanted to be there when the change happened, if I wanted to play a part in the change, then being in relationship with them, providing non-judgmental spaces, supportive non-judgmental spaces, and helping them stay alive, I found to be highly effective.
Mm-hmm.
More so than telling them what they ought to do and praying right. over them and all of that.
Mm-hmm. How has that experience, in ministry, your first 12 years of ministry, how does that translate to this harm reduction perspective, translate into your work within a more traditional church setting?
Yeah. I was really trying to figure out what was my one key, skill, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like competent, skill. My second choice would have been like knowing the difference between what your congregation wants you to be and what they need you to be.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It was really interesting when I came in at Open Door because pastoral care for people who are obviously on the bottom of society, is different than pastoral care for people who, at least from the outside, look like they have all the trappings of the American dream, right? Like, I mean, we're homeowners, we're fully employed. We're like all of that. It was difficult for both of us, right? Like for me in that transition, right? Mm-hmm. And also for my congregation. It was a difficult transition. It's good, and I feel like we're good. But in the beginning, it was a difficult transition. I will say that. So, for a couple of years, so I got here right before the pandemic, right? And then for a couple of years, I shared leadership with another pastor. And then about 2 years ago, Horace McMillan. And then Horace moved, and I've been solo pastor at Open Door for 2 years next month. So it really feels like multiple transitions, right? And then there was the pandemic, which just like, you know, what is time, right? Like, I mean, and so it felt like multiple transitions. Over the pandemic, we went through a values discernment process as a congregation. The world was broken around us, right? Like, there have been number of I'm trying to think of a blanket way to. There's been a number of there's been a lot of tension and strife in our conference in the past, that we hadn't fully dealt with. Right. And we're watching people we love die, and we're watching people we love move away. And so we went through this process of values discernment, like who is Open Door, and does Jackson need Open Door to exist? Right. Like if we closed the doors tomorrow, like what would happen? Right. Would anyone care that isn't in this room right now, right? And a key thing was, so once we got through that, the next question we had was, if we were opening, so Open Door was started in the years right after the Civil Rights Movement. Mennonites from the East came to Mississippi in the Civil Rights Movement as MVS workers. And developed relationships with people of color and indigenous people here. And in Jackson, Mississippi, in 1970, those groups did not worship together. At best, they didn't worship together. At worst, it was worse. So Open Door was founded so that those MVS workers and the people that they have built relationships with here could worship together. And Open Door is incredibly proud of that history, right? Mm-hmm. But what we asked ourselves during our values discernment is, if we were starting today, what would we be willing to risk our church being burned down for? What would we be willing to risk the hate phone calls that the pastor got? What would we be willing to risk for that? And the outcome of that led Open Door to being who it is now, a very proud peace church that is committed to radical inclusivity and welcome. And I feel like this is a really long answer to your story, to your question, Michael, but I feel like I feel like I was my background made me incredibly helpful in that conversation, and helped provide resources and honestly pastoral conversations and grieving and all of that as we grieved who we once were and now weren't anymore. So I am at my most Mennonite, in the sense that I believe God is frugal. Like, God doesn't waste things, right? And it's really easy to look back and say, well, you know, like, that 5-year marriage was a waste of time. Like, I wasted my life. Or that job is 3 years I'll never get back. But I feel like God is able to use those things as God seeks to use us to create the world as it ought to be. And so, yeah. So that's, again, word salad, but yeah.
I mean,
in some way, you can track who Open Door is now to experiences I gained doing that frontline work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah. I mean, I like what you're saying in terms of nothing is wasted. I'm getting what you said in a song kind of combined in my head, but nothing is lost on the breath of God. Oh. Isn't that a song? Someone will tell us.
I am at my least Mennonite when it comes to music. So.
Yeah, me too.
It is in one of the hymnals, but that's what I'm trying to quote. Anyway, because I'm thinking about...
Did Bruce Springsteen sing the hymn?
No. He could. Anyway, I was thinking about that because I'm also thinking about pastors who were new into ministry, and they're having experiences that maybe they didn't expect to have that aren't necessarily positive. And so the way that you're framing it is like, but that was not a waste of time.
No.
That ministry time that you were in, that journey, those 3 years that were really awful,
right,
was not a waste. And I think maybe that goes to what you said earlier about being so hopeful, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that is a very hope-filled way of thinking about how God works in the world and how we join God in ministry together, that nothing is wasted or
right.
lost.
Right. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It also is my kind of hopeful way to avoid the whole, like, toxic everything happens for a reason thing, right? Like, I don't think everything happens for a reason, but right. I do think that nothing is wasted, and so God is able to use mm-hmm. things that seemed at the time like bad experiences
mm-hmm.
To accomplish God's purposes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and thanks for that reframing as well, right? That's not what we're trying to say either.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess along those lines, as you think about someone who's entering ministry, maybe in their first 5 years, you know, given everything you've said, what would be a kernel of wisdom or advice that you would have for someone starting out?
Yeah. You're going to need to know a whole lot about plumbing and roofs.
Michael was just on a roof this morning, his own.
Right. Fixing my roof before the rain came today.
Right. Like, yeah, I mean, seriously, but yes.
Yeah, I hear you saying.
I never knew I would need to know so much about plumbing and roofs. Mm-hmm. So another thing that Bart Campolo told me, again, I was 18 months in, very naive, well-intentioned, and I said, you know, I'm just trying to follow the example of Jesus. And Bart said, I'm going to stop you right there. He said, Jesus loved hard. Jesus went all out. And his ministry lasted 3 years before it killed him. And he said, if you want your ministry to last longer than that, you're probably going to have to figure out how to take care of yourself. And that's not to say Jesus didn't take naps. Like, you know, like Jesus had pretty clear boundaries, right?
Mm-hmm.
But one also wonders what Jesus' 20 years of ministry would have looked like, right? Like, maybe we would be a little closer to the world as it should be than we are right now. I mean, I guess what I would say is, like, you know, you've got to learn to take care of yourself. You've got to learn, like, we love to poo-poo ideas of self-care and boundaries as trite, but, like, they're life-saving. I one time did a census and realized that I probably knew as many social workers with addiction issues as I knew people who were patients of social workers with addiction issues. Dead people don't improve the world, right? You've got to learn to take care of yourself. You pray to Jesus and get a therapist. Like, they're not mutually exclusive. Have people in your life you can trust that aren't your employers. Denominations put a bunch of resources out around spiritual matters, right? Like, it's really easy for me to get Sunday school curriculum for my church, right? It's really easy for us to have webinars about this theological point or that theological point. And almost every pastor I know is struggling to stay afloat. Almost every pastor I talk to from multiple denominations, offline, like, you know, when it's just us, don't know how much longer they can do this, don't know how they can handle their student loan debt, don't know, you know, why they're carrying $50,000 worth of student loan debt to make $50,000 a year. Pastors are struggling, and no one, cynical Hugh, no one is going to care about you as much as you should care about you.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not going to save you. And so you have to be the person in charge of your self-care plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So prioritizing that self-care, finding the beauty. I was struck by that earlier too, you know, taking that time, that it's worth it because your brain needs that time just to kind of sift through and clear out. And then,
you know, there's two stories. Okay. So there's two stories to almost everything. So I am the descendant of enslavers, okay? My great-great-great-grandfather was an enslaver, and that was only stopped by the Civil War. But his brother was an abolitionist, right? Which probably made Thanksgiving interesting, but I get to choose which of those stories I embrace, right? And honestly, it's different at different times, right? Likewise, the world is, people are the worst, right? Like you just go into the comment section of any news article about anything, right? People are horrible. But also, people are amazing, and they make music and songs and poetry. There's this poem I love by Michael Cody. He's an Irish poet. I couldn't think of the word. An Irish poet who wrote this poem called "Though There Be Torturers," and it's describing this duality. I wish I could quote the whole thing to you, but it's describing this duality that, like, yes, there are torturers in the world. And there are also drunk men in bars singing at the top of their lungs, right? That there are men whose souls are wasting away in prison while the choir in the Vatican sings, you know, to exponential heights. That there are two stories in the world. And by choosing to look for beauty, it's prioritizing that story. So you don't get... So the cynical doesn't win.